This is the third day of our seven-day Rahatsu session. So, and welcome to our guests. The Buddha's closing words at the end of the Diamond Sutra. Thus shall you think of all this fleeting world, a star at dawn, a bubble in a stream, a flash of lightning in a summer cloud, a flickering lamp, a phantom, and a dream. Are we seeing the pattern here? Yes, this is the Buddha's exhortation to practice at the end of the Diamond Sutra. One is to meditate on the transitory, a dream, an illusion, a bubble, shadow, dew, a lightning flash. The Buddha's lay disciple, Vimalakirti, puts it rather more bluntly. Friends, this body is so impermanent, fragile, unworthy of confidence, and feeble. It is so insubstantial, perishable, short-lived, painful, filled with diseases and subject to changes. Thus, my friends, as this body is only a vessel of many sicknesses, wise men do not rely on it. It is like a cloud, being characterized by turbulence and dissolution. It is like a flash of lightning, being unstable and decaying every moment. The body is ownerless, being the product of a variety of conditions. When I was in college, and again in graduate school, I lived for a few years in Southern California. I regret that during all that time I never tried surfing, but it always looked like a fun and interesting sport. It's a sport that relies on birth, life, and death. The birth, life, and death of a wave. A surfer is out there waiting for the big one, and a great surge of water rises, and the surfer paddles like mad to get up to speed where he can catch the wave, and then rides its tremendous power towards the beach. But then, the wave curls over, the energy dissipates, and ultimately dies, as what was a huge wall of water collapses into a foamy wash, running up the beach, and then flows back into the ocean whence it came. Over and over it happened. No breaker ever lasted more than a minute or so. All you can do is ride it the best you can until the ride comes to an end. For the most part, that is how most people live. How fragile. How insubstantial. What we call our life in this seemingly solid world of objects, beings, thoughts, and things that move around, act upon each other, appear and disappear according to cause and effect, is actually the thinnest of veneers over something unknown and unknowable, a place that is neither dark nor light, neither deep nor shallow, large nor small, not even a place, really. It goes by many names: the void, dharmakaya, emptiness, the ground of being, and sometimes, mistakenly, death. How do we investigate? How do we explore this? Rohatathasa, a deva, asks the Buddha, Lord, the world's end, where one is neither born, nor ages, nor dies, nor passes away, nor reappears, is it possible to know or see or reach that by traveling there? The Buddha replies, Friend, that there is a world's end, where one is neither born, nor ages, nor dies, or passes away, nor reappears, which is to be known or seen or reached by traveling there, that I do not say. Yet I do not say there is ending of suffering without reaching the world's end. Rather, it is in this fathom-long carcass with its perceptions and its mind that I describe the world, the origin of the world, the cessation of the world, and the way leading to the cessation of the world. So there it is. In this fathom-long carcass, no traveling is necessary, no special equipment needed. All we need is right here, right now, within each of us. And what is this cessation of the world? If you look at books about death and dying, you will find that just about everything written about death and dying is really all about the dying part. Death itself gets hardly mentioned. This is natural, I suppose, as we all see the dying process as parents, friends, pets, others get old, fall ill, and die. And we know full well that we will all experience that process sooner than we might like. I'm sure that all of us have known people who are dying. Of course, that's all of us, really. But those who have been diagnosed with a terminal condition. Or maybe there is no diagnosis, but it is painfully evident that their time is short. But how about those who are dead? I don't think any of us have talked a lot with people who are dead, except perhaps to say a final farewell, with no expectations of whether they actually hear us or not. That's why we find stories of near-death experiences so fascinating. But the problem is that these experiences are near death, not death itself. There is still an I, a self, that experiences something. The descriptions of bright lights or floating out of the body are still events happening in time and space. And such stories seem to me to just raise expectations about what may or may not happen to you or me. Rather like reading too many accounts of enlightenment experiences. We can relate to those who are dying. We try to comfort them, be with them, learn from them. There are many examples of great masters whose very dying is a teaching. They could often predict the exact time of their death. They wrote death poems, admonished their disciples, and passed away, sitting in Zazen. All well and good, inspiring examples, if we are lucky enough to die in peaceful circumstances. But this is still only about dying. Even the death meditation is actually a meditation about the where, when, and how of dying, not of death. As valuable as the support offered to the dying and their families in various hospices and other situations might be. These considerations are incomplete without some attempt to understand and realize death. Contemplation of death itself is crucial for all of us in facing our mortality. René de Montaigne wrote, "Let us disarm him of his novelty and strangeness. Let us converse and be familiar with him, and have nothing so frequent in our thoughts as death. The premeditation of death is the premeditation of liberty. He who has learned to die has unlearned to serve. There is nothing of evil in life for him who rightly comprehends that the privation of life is no evil. To know how to die delivers us from all subjection and constraint." Now the trap here is becoming morbidly obsessed with death. It can lead to a state of panic. Oh my God, I'm going to die. Or a kind of stoic or even cynical acceptance. Life's a bitch and then you die. As one day that flickering lamp will go out and our lives disappear as does the smoke from an extinguished candle. And certainly as we age, death becomes an increasingly proximate reality. The ancient saying goes, "In the midst of life, we are in death." Well, there are a couple of ways to look at this. First, it is a cautionary saying, the recognition that death can happen to anyone at any time. Therefore, one should not waste time in worldly pursuits when death is looking over your shoulder and may tap you at any moment. That is certainly true enough. Second, in the midst of life, we really are in the midst of death. We see death and dying all around us. This is especially evident in agrarian societies, where the cycle of birth and death is an obvious daily occurrence. Animals, birds, livestock are seen to be constantly being born and dying. Is there a third way? A way that is not philosophical speculation or admonitions about mortality. In the midst of life, we are in death. In the midst of death, we are in life. It is just as true. Death is not something that happens. It is not some alien presence that will one day carry you off. It's not even the loss of anything. Death is within each of us at this moment, even as is life. The two are not one whit separate. Death is your true nature every bit as much as life. We do not die. We just discover the true nature of death, which is none other than our own true nature. Montaigne writes of becoming intimate with death. We have always been intimate with death. How can we not be? But we spend almost all of our time and energy on life. We need also to explore death, this unknown and unknowable side of our nature. In the Sutra on the Four Foundations of Mindfulness, the Buddha recommends that you contemplate the mortality of your aging body, and even to spend time in a charnel ground, contemplating the body's corruption, dissolution, and decay into nothing but scattered bones and fragments. If you do this, ask yourself, exactly at what point does my Buddha nature disappear? At the moment I stop breathing, when the heart stops, when my body is invaded by worms, when the flesh dries out and withers, when in that rotting away process am I no longer inherently a Buddha, whole and complete in this moment? Our very Buddha nature is the change itself. If you deny aging and impermanence, you deny your own essential nature. However, as useful as this contemplation may be, it is still looking at death from the outside. You will not understand death by watching the dead any more than you would understand Zazen by watching somebody else do Zazen. We must take another step. Even as in our koan practice, we try to get inside of Zhaozhou or Yunmen, we must see death from the standpoint of death, from the inside. There has to be a genuine experiential familiarity with death, not just with the dying process, but death itself. Only then can one's understanding be truly transformed. All the arguments about stuff that happens before or after death are based on the delusive notions of time and space. But all moments are this moment. All places are this place. All conditions are here and now. Life and death are here now. The moment time and space arises, cause and effect arise. Birth and death arise. The very concept of time inevitably contains the notion of something that extends through time for a limited space. What we call a tree is nothing more than the momentary awareness of a tree. But the present moment does not abide. The only thing that actually extends through time is the thought memory of a tree. And it is that to which we give a spurious reality. The real tree cannot be spoken of or thought of. How do we know that we're alive? We see, hear, taste, smell, touch, and perceive thoughts. But who is it that really does all that? When I see a dog, does that mean I created the dog? Or did it just arise in our consciousness? Did it arise as our consciousness? When we hear a dog bark, did we create that sound? Do we create thoughts? Or do they just arise in our consciousness as our consciousness? Objects of sight and sound and mind have no existential reality. No eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, or mind. Our practice is to let go of all these, including thought objects. It is to let go of everything that defines you as alive. If one loses sight, is that dying? Is a blind person less alive? If one loses hearing, is that dying? Is a deaf person less alive? If one loses taste or smell or oral bodily sensation, are we less alive? And then what about thoughts? If one loses the perception of thoughts, is that dying? Many would say yes. Brain dead. Clinical death, flatlined. Why are thought objects so special, so much more important than sight or sound objects? Why do we cling especially to them? Why are we so in love with our thoughts? It comes from the internal-external dichotomy, I suspect. As long as we think of all other senses as coming from out there and thoughts arising in here, we are a slave to this created self. This is how we die, how we come to the cessation of the world. All boundaries disappear. There is no longer an inside or outside. You become completely open. Light and shadow pass through you. No one sees. Sounds pass through you. No one hears. Wind and air pass through you. No one senses. Thoughts arise and pass away. There is no thinker. Death is the letting go of all illusions that arise out of the dichotomy of self and other. We can let go of them moment by moment in our practice here and now in Sesshin. Or we let go of them willy-nilly at the end of life. Let go of seeing. Thus, if we go blind, it is no great matter. We are whole and complete in the moment. Let go of hearing. Thus, if we go deaf, it is no great matter. We are whole and complete in the moment. Other senses the same. At all times and in all conditions, blind, deaf, alive, dead, we are whole and complete in the moment. And then let go of thoughts. Thus, the great silence is no great matter. Yet it is the greatest matter of all. If you engage the practice, if you engage mu, or the breath, or just sitting, enter zazen completely, all of this will happen of itself. Body and mind drop away. Only when you have died in this way can you really come to life. But you do not return to life as it was. We manifest marvelous function that is not defined or constrained by concepts of life and death. This is life without fear. As Montaigne said, if you have learned to die, you have unlearned to serve. You are delivered from subjection and constraint. The end of this karmic life is no longer an issue. In our practice, the veil between the world of illusion and the great silent void between life and death becomes thinner and thinner until it disappears altogether. They were never separate. Let go of seeing, become blind. Let go of hearing, become deaf. Let go of all taste, smell, and touch, and let go of thought. There is nothing else to take away. In the midst of life, we are in death. In the midst of death, we are in life. This is the great reality and the great mystery. The Buddha said, wanting nothing, with all your heart, stop the stream. When the world dissolves, everything becomes clear. Go beyond this way or that way to the farther shore where the world dissolves and everything becomes clear. Beyond this shore, beyond the further shore, beyond the beyond where there is no beginning, no end. Without fear, go. Together with all beings, we realize the way.